It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at a proposed bill in Wisconsin that could change requirements for the state's food share program and mandate what kind of food some dollars have to be used for.
First, we check out some new research that looks at the status of large carnivores around the world. Animals like lions, wolves, and bears fall into that category. They're some of the most charismatic and admired creatures in the world. And according to our next guest, they're also some of the most imperiled.
Populations of large carnivores are declining and are in danger of disappearing, in some cases altogether. Our guest says that could have some serious effects on ecosystems around the world.
Joining us now is William Ripple. He's an ecologist and professor at Oregon State University and lead author of the recent paper about that problem. William, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Veronica.
So in the paper, you looked at the planet's 31 largest carnivores, animals like dingoes, lions, bears, and the majority of these have experienced big problems, big population declines in the last two centuries. What kind of declines are we talking about there? How big are they?
Well, for these 31 species, on average, 77% are experiencing continued population declines. And in addition to that, 61% of these large carnivores are considered threatened for risk of extinction. And finally, they only occupy about 47% of their historical range. So according to a number of these metrics, these carnivores as a group are in trouble.
Now, 77% of them in trouble. So we're talking about globally here. So what are the common factors at play? Why are they declining?
Well, the in every case, the carnivores are declining because of human activities. Some are direct and some are indirect. For example, many regions have experienced habitat loss or fragmentation. In other cases, the carnivores are persecuted by humans by hunting, trapping, poisoning, because of humans' concern about their own safety or their livestock. In some cases, the carnivores are used; their body parts are used for traditional medicine, especially in the East. But more so in the West, there's more uses for fur. On clothing. And then finally, one of the bigger factors is the depletion of the prey of the carnivores. So these animals, they're typically called ungulates, like deer and elk and moose. And these large mammals are declining at a fast rate also. And the carnivores need to have their food. So those are some major threats to the carnivores.
Well, keeping in mind that we're talking about complex ecological systems and systems all over the world, what can you tell us about the role that one or two of these large carnivores play in the world's ecosystems?
Yes. In general, when the large carnivore declines or is removed from the ecosystem, its prey increases to the point sometimes where the herbivorous prey, the herbivores that eat the plants, they eat themselves out of house and home, causing various cascading problems in the ecosystem that might affect biodiversity, for example.
When you look at an example like, I think it was baboons.
Yeah.
There are striking things there. You know, you don't think that much about lions going away having an effect with baboons, but it has real, tangible, and not great effects on the humans who are living in that area. Can you talk about baboons?
Sure. Well, in Africa, olive baboons are a prey for both lions and leopards. And one thing is that recent research has showed that lions have dramatically decreased in Western Africa. They're down to about 250 lions. So what research has shown is where we lose the lions and the leopards, the olive baboons' numbers increase dramatically. And these highly dense baboons can have a number of different cascading effects. For example, they can affect their prey. They can potentially spread disease to humans because of their high numbers. And in extreme cases, they have major raids on the crops that farmers are growing. And it's been documented that in some cases, the where there are these heavy crop losses due to baboons, that the farmers keep their children home from school to guard the fields. So that's one example coming out of Africa.
Yeah, so these kids aren't going to school because there are baboons, and there are so many baboons because there aren't as many lions. I mean, it gets complicated, but it's pretty fascinating when you look at it. And another example is the link, as you see it, between carnivore populations declining and climate change. How is there a connection there?
Well, one thing that we discussed in the paper is that the carnivores, in generally, they're on top of the food web, and they help stabilize the food web. These are all the other animals that live in the ecosystems, and their stabilizing effect creates a healthier ecosystem, typically, and that can help buffer against climate change. So that's one example, and I can give you another one from the sea otter, briefly.
Yeah.
So this is a an aquatic carnivore. The sea otter lives off the west coast of North America, where the otter preys on urchins, and the urchins eat the kelp or displace the kelp. So where we have otters, we have lower urchin numbers and healthier kelp forest. So those kelp are plants that store carbon in their tissue, and there's a so this is what's called a carbon storage benefit to help mitigate climate change. So another example would be where wolves might limit the herbivore mammals from the eating of the tree sprouts. And when those trees grow taller, they can also store carbon, which helps mitigate climate change.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the web of relationships there. Another interesting example is the puma. Can you tell us what happens when puma numbers decline?
Yeah, so the puma is also known by the name cougar or mountain lion in some places, but it's a large cat that we studied in the canyons of southwestern United States in Zion National Park and Yosemite Valley of Yosemite National Park. But, for example, in Zion, we found that when in Zion Canyon, when the humans increased their visitation to the canyon in around the 1930s, after it became a national park, all these humans scared the pumas out of the canyon, and the deer figured that out, and so they congregated there because it's a safe place to be, and they their browsing on the plants was significant, to the point of on the stream banks, the plants were suppressed on the stream banks, and there was an increase in channel erosion, widening the river, and also a loss of aquatic habitat. So there we've documented how the decline of the cougar and the increase in the deer and increase in deer browsing affected biodiversity factors like everything from butterflies to lizards to frogs and potentially fish because of the loss of stream habitat.
You and your colleagues, as well as some other scientists, are calling for a global large carnivore initiative. Within this group of people, how important would you say it is that we restore the numbers of carnivores on the planet?
Well, a lot of times these days, people are talking mostly about climate change as being, the one and only big threat. But, of course, there are other environmental problems, and we think that this globally, this issue doesn't get as much attention. So we think discuss the potential for a global large carnivore initiative. And this would be where numerous countries collaborate on setting priorities for research and establishing actions for conservation of these species.
William, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
We've been talking to William Ripple. He is an ecologist and a professor at Oregon State University.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at proposed legislation that would require the purchase of healthy foods with a large portion of food assistance funding here in Wisconsin.
But first, here's a look at some of the latest news with WPR's Noah Oshinsky.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the hour, we'll speak with one man who spent a year using Google Glass.
First, should Wisconsin require that 2/3 of food share benefits be spent on healthier food?
The state Senate held a public hearing yesterday to consider a new bill that would turn that idea into law. That bill is already passed in the Assembly.
The author of the bill that would create the 2/3 requirement is Representative Dean Cawford from NENA. He's here with us now. Later in the hour, we'll hear from the Hunger Task Force as to why they don't think the measure should pass.
You can also call with any questions you might have about the bill and share your thoughts and opinions. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234.
Representative Dean Cawford joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we jump into your new legislation, can you explain what food share benefits are and who's getting them?
Well, folks that are eligible for food share, they have to meet a certain percent of poverty line that then they're eligible for food stamps. So there's a lot of people who are getting them, people who are laid off from work, the poor, people who have, lost their job, or they find themselves in a, unfortunate situation where, they need assistance, people with kids. The benefits is supposed to be for, mostly, children. That's how it started out. But a lot of seniors are getting food share. And a lot of people, it's income-based. And so there's about $1.2 billion is spent in the state of Wisconsin every year on food stamps. So there's a lot of people that need it and are getting it.
There's a general sense that we in America should be eating a little healthier. This would actually require people to do so in part. What's the reasoning behind this requirement that 2/3 of the food share funding go to healthier foods?
Well, there's a couple things. When I came up with this legislation, a lot of grocery store clerks, convenience store folks and that, they were stopping me and they were saying, Dean, what people are using their taxpayer dollar supported food stamp cards for was just not healthy and it was just not good. And there was a lot of soda and a lot of snacks and nachos and chips. And that got me thinking. And then I talked to people at the grocery stores. And some people just don't make good choices. The majority of them do. And the idea behind food stamps is to make sure that we have good, nutritious, staple foods in the cupboard so that folks can, get by when they're, having some difficult times or they don't make enough to, buy a lot of their own groceries. And I have nothing against the program. And I don't want to cut the dollars that people are getting or lower them. I just think that there's a responsibility that people need to utilize those dollars in a smart way. And there's also one other thing. If people aren't eating healthy, if they're not, doing the right things with these dollars and eating good, nutritious meals, then they're going to end up in the medical assistance program because they're going to get things like diabetes, obesity, a lot of illnesses if you're not eating properly. And then taxpayers are going to pay for their medical needs through the medical assistance program here in this state. So that's the impetus behind it.
What qualifies as healthy food?
Well, that was the difficult part, and I'm not going to deny that. You know, there's a lot of different variations. People, you know, what they think different. And your guest later, they testified the other day, they tried to give, at the Milwaukee Hunger Task Force, nutritious food. And we kind of caught that and said, they're trying to give away nutritious food. So what we did is, rather than be the, you know, total food police and say, you know, this is what you can buy, this is what you can't. You know, it was hard to make this decision, and we just didn't want to say, we'd rather say you can buy this and you can't, rather than you cannot buy, you know, soda and munchies and nachos. So what we did is we took the WIC program. There's a program in the state of Wisconsin called WIC, and a lot of women and children qualify for WIC, and it's a list of healthy foods for pregnant mothers, babies. And we went to that list, and we took that list, and then we expanded it. We added fish. We added meat. We added poultry. We added potatoes and a whole list of other things to the WIC list, because that's generally considered an acceptable list of healthy foods. So it's quite an expansive list. I mean, if you really go through it, it's very expansive. And then what we said is, because some people were saying, oh, this is terrible, so we said, okay, let's change the bill and say two-thirds of the money has to go towards these good, healthy, nutritious, you know, staples, and one-third you can buy in anything you want. A family of four, the average family of four in Wisconsin on SNAP, on food stamps, gets about $600. So that a month. And some people can argue that's enough or not enough. But the point is that $400 of that needs to go for this list of, you know, healthy, nutritious foods. $200 of it can go for chips, soda, whatever else they want to buy that's allowable under the program. Alcohol and cigarettes are not allowed.
I want to go to our callers on this. We've got Terry with us in Two Rivers. Terry, hi.
Hi. I really get angry at hearing the victim always being prosecuted. And we have a problem in this country with nutrition and with obesity, and this is not the route to go. We need to have our foods be more local, not shipped in from California, and we need to have fresh foods and vegetables in the grocery store. And there should be at least 40 different kinds of fruits and vegetables that are grown in this area. And
We're not doing anything to victimize anyone. We're not doing anything to say that people can't buy fruits and vegetables. We're kind of encouraging it under this bill.
But one concern, I think Terry was alluding to it, is that maybe they don't, in some places we hear the concept of food deserts, maybe people don't have access to a lot of the healthier food.
Well, I learned about the food deserts and that too, and so one day I did take a trip to Milwaukee, and I visited some of these food deserts and some of these convenience stores in the inner city and that. Almost all of them, in the Quick Trips now and the, you know, all that, they have produce, they have fruits, they have vegetables, they have a lot of healthier things than they used to. The problem is the cost. I mean, they charge more than, you know, the grocery stores. And the food deserts is a genuine concern in some areas of the state, and I recognize that.
Thanks for the call, Terry. We'll go to Dan in Menominee now. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. So I have a question for you when considering what food. Now, I'm all for a healthy diet, and I really do kind of applaud steps towards that. But in this case, you're asking people who are really, really kind of hard up to make decisions about their calorie intake, and you had said that some make poor decisions, but for the amount of money you spend, junk food and less healthy food is generally much, much more calorie dense. And in some cases, when people are very low income, that's actually quite appealing. So what kind of thought was gone into, you know, calorie density versus cost of food? And I can take my answer off the air.
Sure. You know, that is one of the issues that's been brought up, and I don't really have a strong answer for it. I just know that, you know, when we've had the hearings both times, once in the Assembly, once in the Senate, some of those things came up, and those are challenges that are going to have to be met. Some people are in special diets. Some people are, you know, glucose-free diets and different things that may be a problem. And you know, these folks, I'm willing to help them. These people they need the assistance, and us taxpayers, I think we have a responsibility to help people who are in a situation where they need this. And so there's no meanness, or we're going to take anything away. My first proposal, I thought about giving it an incentive to buy it, but that doesn't work. Other states have tried it. So the calorie intake in that's one thing. The one thing that strikes me is a couple things. The people who are most strongly against this are Pepsi, the soda companies, and the snack food industry. Those are the people who are arguing most about this, and that's because they're making a lot of sales in junk food and soda. And we all know that those aren't healthy for you, and I'm guilty too. But I think everything's okay in moderation, so it's a tough question to answer.
Representative Crawford, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I would just say, when the Milwaukee Hunger Task Force is on, one of the things, we were told in the assembly, at least.
We are fresh out of time. That was Dean Crawford, Republican Assembly Representative from Neenah, talking about the new food share legislation he has.
And we'll take your calls coming up, 800-642-1234. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about whether or not the state should require that 2/3 of food share benefits be spent on healthier foods.
We just heard from State Representative Dean Crawford, who authored a bill that would create that requirement. The bill passed in the Assembly. The Senate held a public hearing on the issue yesterday.
Now we're going to speak with Maureen Fitzgerald, Advocacy Director at the Hunger Task Force in Milwaukee, a group that opposes the proposed law.
We'd like to hear from you as well. Do you think that this is something the state should require, or is it up to the recipients of food share benefits how they spend them? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on our Central Time Facebook page. Maureen Fitzgerald, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the bill's stated goal is to help improve the health of people in Wisconsin. Do you see faults with that and how they're trying to do it?
No, I think it's a great goal. I think the intent behind the bill is a great intent. We all should eat better. We should all try to be more healthy. The problem that we have is the way the bill goes about achieving that goal.
So how so? Why do you object to this idea that some of the money should be limited to healthier food and avoiding the junk food?
Well, Hunger Task Force opposes the bill for really three simple reasons. One, it's going to increase hunger in the state of Wisconsin. It's going to stigmatize poor people who are just trying to buy food to feed themselves. And lastly, it's going to be wildly expensive without any guaranteed benefit to anyone.
And Representative Crawford said, by your standards, I guess, when you give out food, you give out healthier food. You don't give out snacks and soda. His argument, I think, why should taxpayers effectively buy snacks and soda for people?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to look at is what this bill actually does. When you asked Representative Crawford who receives food share, in Wisconsin, 62% of food share are minor, seniors, blind, and disabled folks. And when you talk about how this is going to affect people, we're really looking at people having to create two grocery shopping lists. They're going to have a personal shopping list and a government shopping list. And the average benefit for households is not $600. It's actually $239. And we find that a lot of families run out of food by the end of the month, and then they have to rely on emergency food like food pantries and meal programs.
You mentioned the stigma surrounding food stamps or now food share. And Representative Crawford started off by saying he had in part been inspired by grocery store clerks observing what people were buying. Do you think we as a society and as a government should back off and not judge what people have in their shopping carts, food share or no?
Well, I think one thing is it's really the urban myth that you talk about where, oh, the person in front of me was buying lobster or crab. I mean, the reality is that most seniors who receive this benefit are only receiving $15 a month. We helped a senior last week connect to Food Share. She was an 82-year-old widow. She had never been on the program before, had worked her entire life to put money into the system, and that's really what Food Share is federal tax dollars coming back to people when they're in times of crisis or need. And with this bill, when she goes to the grocery store, we're going to make her check out twice. And we're going to tell her, with your $15, instead of buying the protein shakes that you like to buy with this program because the staples you get a different way, you're going to have $10 to spend the way the state tells you to spend it, and then $5 to buy your protein shake that's going to keep you healthy.
How would you propose encouraging people to eat healthier in Wisconsin absent this legislation?
Well, Representative Crawford doesn't need to look very far to see that other states are doing great incentive programs. Incentive programs around low-income families really work. One of your previous callers said something about local foods and keeping the money local. One great thing that Michigan and Minnesota are both doing is they have incentive programs that connect people to farmers markets. And what that happens is if you swipe your EBT card for $10, you get $10 to spend at the farmer's market to buy fresh fruits and vegetables. That helps the farmers, it keeps the money in the community, and it also helps low-income families. And it actually has been shown to then increase the healthy foods that they buy when they go to the grocery store.
Have there been any suggestions to do something like that here in Wisconsin?
Dane County has a great program. Hunger Task Force is about to implement a program in Milwaukee that does the same thing. But I think Representative Crawford, if we introduced a bill in the state legislature to make it statewide, that would be fantastic. Then we'd help families all across the state.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Jackie with us in Hixton. Jackie, hi.
Hello.
What do you think about this, Jackie?
Well, I think that the person that is trying to push the bill should live the life. The people that are on food share, a lot of them do the best they can do. But when you put up a can of green beans for $1.36 and a box of hamburger helper for $1, a family needs to eat.
Thanks for the call, Jackie. And that, Maureen, is something another caller had suggested earlier. Sometimes the most calories you can get, you can make your dollar go further with foods that we don't think of as being as healthy as the vegetables and the fruits.
Right. One thing that's not on the government's list in this bill are things like pasta, macaroni and cheese, soup, things that families rely on. We worked with a mother this past summer who had three children. She was escaping a domestic violence situation, and we connected her to food share. But her first apartment outside, on her own, had no stove, no refrigerator, and she had no car. So when we're talking about food deserts, we're also talking about transportation. And food share is really a way to get back on your feet. And this bill actually would then tell her what kind of cereal she can buy.
Thanks for the call, Jackie. We'll go now to Mike with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it sounded extremely reasonable, and I think opposition to it is, it's really for what, if you're getting $600 in food assistance, I don't think a few very reasonable restrictions is unreasonable to ask for.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. So the money's coming from the rest of us, a few strings attached, not such a big deal, he says, Maureen.
Well, I think it's a big deal when you look at what this actually means. We've all been to the grocery store and done the self-service checkout where you go in and you check out. What this bill would really require is a complete overhaul of the technology that Wisconsin uses with their EBT cards, which are the Quest cards that the food stamp benefits are on. And we have to remember that food stamp benefits are a federal benefit, that it's coming from federal tax dollars. The state of Wisconsin does not pay into the benefit system for food share. It's actually administrative costs that the state splits 50-50 with the federal government to run the program. But this would be a completely Wisconsin-funded program where you would have to overhaul the technology, not only for the cards themselves to require a double swipe, so you get two-thirds with one swipe, and then the second swipe is one-third, but you'd actually require that senior who's going in to check out once with the card and then come through and check out again. So are they going to require grocers to have a grocery helper at each line? Because I think self-service is going to be a thing of the past for people. There has been no fiscal analysis of the state absorbing that. The first bill place that responsibility on the grocers, and the state has now said that they're going to absorb that cost, which we believe is going to be astronomical.
We heard from that caller and from Representative Crawford the number of about $600 a month. You mentioned some people getting as little as $15 a month to supplement their food needs. How wide or how big a range is there in the amount of money, amount of food assistance people are receiving?
Well, the amount that you receive is based upon your income, so and the in your household size. So what it looks at is how what your income is, what your household size is, and then what your expenses are. But for the state of Wisconsin, according to the Department of Health Services, the average household for the last month that they posted, which was October of 2013, was $239. The average per person was $127. And most seniors are looking at about $15. And we have to remember that recently in November, every single person who is receiving food share in the state of Wisconsin saw their benefits reduced. There was a stimulus package that the funding expired, and so that impacted food stamp recipients in the, all across the nation. But every single person in the state of Wisconsin saw their benefits reduced starting in November of last year.
And how big a factor is food share in combating hunger in the state alongside food banks and things like that?
Food share is really the first line of defense. When you talk about those ARRA cuts, that was a $5 billion cut, $5 billion in 1 month across the country. That $5 billion is equal to the entire nation's charitable food system for the entire year.
Well,
so in 1 month, they reduced the amount of food stamp benefits that it would take an entire nation, you know, to make up for all charities across the nation.
This legislation we've been talking about requiring healthier food for 2/3 of the food share money, I know you're not wild about it. How worried are you that it'll pass?
Well, if it were to pass, it would still require a waiver from the USDA. Because this would be a program that would be different. The Quest card is mandated to be interoperable between all states, and this would change that for the state of Wisconsin. So we're hopeful that if this were to pass, that there would not be a waiver from the USDA.
Maureen, thanks a lot for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
That was Maureen Fitzgerald, Advocacy Director at the Hunger Task Force, talking about legislation that would require people getting food assistance to spend most of the money on healthier foods.
We spoke earlier in the hour with Representative Dean Crawford, who proposed that bill. If you missed it, you can find it on the WPR website on the Central Time show page.
Coming up, we'll talk to a technology writer about his experience using that Google Glass for the better part of a year.
Here's a check of the latest headlines with Noah Ovshinsky from WPR News. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up next hour, we'll find out about a surprising link between reality TV and teen pregnancy.
First, our next guest was one of the chosen few who got to explore the world of Google Glass before the rest of us. Matt Honan wore the smart headset for about a year and wrote about his experience for Wired magazine. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I want to start with at the very beginning, for tragically unhip people like me, what exactly is Google Glass?
Google Glass is a little piece of headgear you can wear. I hesitate to call them glasses because they don't really look quite like glasses. There's a kind of a piece that goes along one of your temples that has some electronics in it that lets it talk to your phone or Wi-Fi and relay internet stuff to a little crystal that sits in front of one of your eyes. And you can see on the display things like your latest email, directions, if someone tweets at you, you can see that. And basically, the idea is it sort of frees you from having to look at your phone to get all that information.
It reminds me a little bit of the visor that Geordi LaFarge used to wear on Next Generation on Star Trek. Does it feel like a visor like that?
It feels a little bit like that, and it feels a little bit, it feels almost as weird as wearing that would feel, I think,
Do you feel like a cyborg?
A little bit. Honestly, when you start wearing it a lot, you kind of forget that you're wearing it. So you don't. But other people might remind you that you look like a cyborg.
Well, let's start with more about what it was like for you. The title of your piece references a term that's come up for those that wear these Google Glass pieces. I'm not going to use it on the air, but it's not a complimentary term. Are people who wear Google Glass seen as jerks?
I think there's a little bit of perception that they might be. There's a pejorative for them that that we can't say on the air. But I think that you know, I don't necessarily think they are, but I think that there's this issue that, one, it's very unfamiliar to people. Two, it's pretty strange looking. And three, it's very exclusive, you know. So, like, I think there were 1,500 initial units that were sent out, and not, you know, some order of magnitude more than that now. So it's very much this kind of exclusive club if you've got them. And I think that that has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
How did you manage to get one yourself?
Well, honestly, because I'm at Wired, you know, and they wanted us to have them in order to learn about them and write about them.
So did you have to be someone of consequence to get one?
Well, not necessarily consequence, but you could. They had what was called an Explorer program, and you could apply for it. And so, like, I know that I'm pretty sure that the penguin keeper at the San Francisco Zoo was one of the people who got them. And so they tried to send them to, like, you know, people in all kinds of different walks of life. It wasn't necessarily like, you know, you had to be a very powerful venture capitalist or something like that.
Right.
You know, but they didn't send it just to, if you're, you know, they didn't send them just to anybody who wanted it either.
So hopefully the penguins weren't freaked out for a year.
I don't think the penguins noticed.
One of the things that you loved about Google Glass was the application Google Now. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So Google Now is this application they have, and you can have it on your phone. I believe now it's in the Chrome browser also, where basically you give Google access to your email. I mean, they already have it, but you basically give them permission to dig through your email. And it'll do things like say, hey, you have a flight reservation at 3 o'clock, and it's time for you to leave for the airport if you're going to get there on time. It'll just pop up these notifications in a timely fashion. Like, you know, you might go outside, and it's just a little bit before lunchtime. It'll say, hey, there's a restaurant right there. It's Thai food. You know, there's another restaurant over there that's Chinese, and kind of, you know, direct you to those places you might want to go. If it's in the morning, it would send you to a breakfast place. It's just sort of these serendipitous sort of you know, suggestions that Google is able to provide because Google knows a lot about you.
So you're not asking it to do that stuff. It's just doing it?
Right. You're not asking for it at all. It's, you know, and like I said, you can have it on your phone too, but I loved the Google Now for your face because when it's on your phone, I don't know about you, but my phone like buzzes with something, it seems like every 30 seconds, you know, some sort of notification. And so to have those presented to you instead of having to pull the thing out of your pocket and remember to look at it was pretty handy, but no, you don't have to ask it for this stuff. It'll just tell you. It'll just say, like, you know, you've got a meeting in half an hour. You need to leave now.
So with my phone, let's say I get a notification, it buzzes or whatever. Generally, I have to click OK or what have you, and then get it to go back to, you know, whatever setting it was at before to clear the notification. What do you do with Google Now in that scenario?
You can dismiss them. You basically the little piece along the temple that holds the electronics has it's touch sensitive, so you can swipe on it to dismiss things or to scroll through them. But it just kind of goes away. It'll pop up and just go away.
So it's not completely hands free. You still have to be moving your hand along your temple or something.
You can. You can. It is hands free when you're taking actions. So you can use the little command phrase. It's OK Google. Or I'm sorry, OK Glass, and it'll do things. You can say, like, OK Glass, record a video, and it'll start shooting video. OK Glass, take a picture. It'll take a picture. And they've now released some applications where you can have let third-party applications also take advantage of that. So you can, you know, be giving voice commands to the specific apps rather than just sort of the system itself.
So you are, you know, doing what Bluetooth people do and muttering to yourself.
Oh, yeah, you look like a crazy person sometimes.
And speaking of sharing video with people, you actually wanted to have your wife, broadcast her birth using Google Glass.
Broadcast, I think, is the wrong term, but I did want to wear Google Glass while she was giving birth. I thought it would be a great way to, like, you know, it's our second child. And I remember the first time one of the things that that I thought was awkward is me sort of trying to take pictures while this was going on. You know, I didn't want to, like, have to, like, stop paying attention and pull out a camera and take a picture. But I did want to sort of document the moment. And I thought that Google Glass would actually be a very good way to do that. I thought that, you know, I could, without having to, like, stop paying attention or be pulled out of the moment, I could take pictures while she was delivering our second child. The other thing I thought was that because you can do video chats basically with people where they see what you see. So instead of, like, if you think about how you do something on FaceTime or a normal video chat, you're looking at someone and they're looking back at you. On Google Glass, you're looking at someone, they're looking at what you see. So, you know, you can connect with, and in my case, I wanted to connect with my in-laws and my parents. you know, so they could kind of be in the room with us while that was going on. Probably not at the moment of birth itself, but, you know, maybe right afterwards.
Yeah, and so how did that go over with your wife?
That did not go over very well at all. Like, she was she was pretty hostile to that idea, actually. She just, you know, you think about the device being off-putting, and although it might have allowed me to stay in the moment, she was concerned that with me having this strange thing on my face, that it would take her out of that moment. And I think that really speaks to, like, the big problem that Google Glass has to overcome, because I wasn't asking or wanting to do anything different than I would do anyway. I would just be doing the exact same thing I might with my phone, except instead of taking pictures with something in my hand, I'd be taking pictures with something that's on my face. And I think Google Glass's big problem, and a lot of wearables' big problem, are the way they look, because people really notice them and they feel, you know, weirded out by them.
How did using Google Glass change the way you felt about your other gadgetry, things like your cell phone?
It actually made me much more conscious of how often I pull out my cell phone and made me wish that I didn't do that as much. I think that's one of the things we've, as a society, fallen into a habit of doing that is a bad habit and almost a universal bad habit. You know, that we're just constantly pulling our phones out of our pockets to look at things and, you know, to get caught up in our apps, caught up in our notifications, caught up in all these things that are pretty unimportant. And one of the things I really like about Google Glass is it is very easy to kind of, you know, go through things very quickly and not have to sort of take that moment and pull something out of your pocket and look at it and put it back in again. It's just subtly different in the way that it can send you a notification, and you can look at it, and you can dismiss it without having to, like, really stop what you're doing to do that.
Well, it's interesting because you're saying, in a way, you're more connected with people. It's less intrusive than a cell phone is because everybody looks down and is prodding away their cell phones.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you said there's this huge barrier just in the way that it looks, and almost that is more intrusive than fooling around with your cell phone.
I think so. I mean, I think one of the big things that Google has to figure out before they make this a consumer device is, how do you make it look good? How do you make it look like a normal pair of glasses? The other thing is you have to, you know, get people to understand that it's not a tool for surveillance or something like that, which I think is a reasonable fear, especially in light of all this NSA stuff that's going on. People are concerned about where this information is going and who's recording what and what are they doing with it. But they certainly have to solve the aesthetic issue.
Do we need to just get over ourselves and get used to stuff like Google Glass, whether or not we like it right now? Is this stuff just coming no matter what?
I think this stuff is coming no matter what, yeah. I think that wearable cameras and wearable displays are coming no matter what. I do. I don't think it's going to be next year, but I think 5 years from now, stuff like that is going to be pretty common. And I think it's actually worth thinking about, like, you know, what valid concerns with that are. Like, you know, what are our privacy concerns with that? What are our, you know, the concerns about how that data is stored, how it's shared, how it can be used, where it can be worn, where it's inappropriate? We need to start thinking about that and coming up with sort of, you know, agreements as a society, because it's coming, and smartphones took us by surprise.
Do you miss your Google Glass? Do you wish you were still wearing it?
Oh, I have it at my desk. I've actually got a brand new one.
You've got a brand new one.
They've just released a slightly upgraded version, and I've got another one on my desk. I had white until the beginning of the year. Now I've got an orange one, which is even more noticeable.
All right, it sounds like you're a convert, huh?
Oh, yeah, I like it. You know, I mean, I do feel awkward wearing it, and I do feel very self-conscious in it a lot of times. For example, I was going to wear it to lunch today with a friend of mine. I was like, you know what? I know this will bother Jim, so I'm not going to do that. But no, I like it. Yeah, I like it a lot. And I think when the weird thing is like, people have the same reaction again and again and again. They're like, man, that's really strange looking and weird. Can I try it?
Well, Matt, thanks for giving us a glimpse of the future.
Thank you.
Matt Honan wrote about his year wearing Google Glass for Wired magazine, where he's on staff as a senior writer.
Coming up, how MTV shows about teen parents might be affecting the teen birth rate in real life. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.